call our last case for the December calendar, 99-1250 CR State versus Piddington. We have as our first counsel, is it Chater?
Chater.
I was pretty close. Thank you, Ms. Chater, representing Mr. Piddington.
Yes.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm attorney Michelle Chater. I represent Michael Piddington. When I was in Greece, I was going through a phase where I wasn't eating meat. And I went to a restaurant where they were serving lamb, some sort of poultry dish, and I think a steak. And I tried to explain to the waiter in the best clearest English I could come up with that I didn't want to eat meat, and he finally, there was a glimmer of light, and he said, fish. Is fish okay? And I said, fish is great. Not a problem. I'll eat fish. And he's gone for a while, and he comes back, and he brings me a plate of squid. And I tried to explain to him that there's no way in America that squid is going to constitute fish. You don't think, if you're ordering fish, that you're going to get squid. And that's about as close as I can come to what happened to Mr. Piddington on the night that he was arrested. And I think what the Court of Appeals did in their decision was to effectively tell Mr. Piddington that not only is he going to eat squid, he's going to have to like it, and that's the best he's going to get, because that's all that he's entitled to get. And I think that to that extent, the Court of Appeals erred. The decision of the Court of Appeals held, one, that when we were arguing that Mr. Piddington could not have possibly been properly informed of his rights under the informing the accused form and the implied consent law, that that argument was an argument of subjective confusion, which had been explicitly rejected by the court in State versus Quelley.
Counsel, is it your position then, which seems to be rather absolute, that any time that there is a language barrier, that it would be subjective confusion? In other words, let me just say that in this case it was a person who had been deaf from birth, but let's say it was a person who spoke only Russian or Swahili or some language that would be, rather than say Hispanic or something that maybe the police were prepared for, would that be the same? In other words, if you don't understand the language that's in the informing the accused form, then you would have to have an interpreter, certified interpreter there to explain it to you?
I'm saying, first of all, that that argument is not a claim of subjective confusion. There is nothing subjective about that. It's an objective standard in this case. Mr. Piddington could not possibly have been able to adequately understand
this. So does that mean, as a practical matter, that when this situation is encountered, that it is the absolute obligation of the arresting of the officers, whether it's state patrol, county sheriff, whatever, to have on staff or available someone who is certified in that area?
It depends. In the context of a drunk driving arrest, the officer always has the option, pursuant to State versus Zilke and California versus Schmerber and State versus Bowling, to do an other constitutional means test. And the court has held that the rapid dissipation and absorption of alcohol in an individual's system per se constitutes an exigency. So the officer has the choice of not even invoking the provisions of the implied consent law, and they can still obtain an alcohol test from an individual. They don't have to read them the informing the accused form. They don't have to get them an interpreter. They don't have to do any of those things. Zilke has decided that years ago. But if the officer wants to invoke the implied consent law, which then exposes the driver to not only the threat of prosecution, but also the threat of revocation of his operating privileges if he says no to the test, then I think that officer is obligated under the meaning of the implied consent law, under the equal protection clause, and under the due process clause.
Does it make any difference whether driving is a privilege rather than a constitutional obligation or right?
I don't believe that it does. Because, excuse me?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I don't believe that it does make a difference. It is a privilege, but the state has imposed onto that privilege certain rights and responsibilities of the parties. If an individual is read the informing the accused form and says no to the test and does not have a basis to have said no, a physical inability to submit to the test, for example.
But here he is a high school graduate. Here he read the form and he initialed what he apparently read.
That's correct. But the fact that Mr. Pittington is a high school graduate does not, of course, convey
What I was conveying to you was that he had the ability to read and that he did initial the form. Does that make any difference?
He had some ability to read. We don't know what that ability is. Statistically, if he fits in with the majority of other hearing-impaired individuals, his ability to read was probably somewhere at a third to a fourth grade reading level. The likelihood that he's able to read at a 10th grade level would put him in the top 5% of hearing impaired individuals.
Is that in the record? I guess I missed that.
It's in the briefs, Your Honor.
Okay.
It was submitted to the court in the amicus brief.
All right. Counsel, the ability of your client to read and to correspond, if you will, is certainly demonstrated, is it not, by the notes that went back and forth between the officer and the defendant?
Some ability on behalf of my client to read and correspond is demonstrated in those notes, Your Honor. However, if the court looks at those notes, they are extremely simple things. They're very simple concepts. Walk 9 steps. Very simple responses on behalf of Mr. Pittington. And if the court looks at what Mr. Pittington wrote, most of those sentences are not even close to being grammatically correct. I think that the sentences that are there convey that he doesn't have a very good understanding of the English language. If the court looks at the informing the accused form, however, which is written at a 12th grade reading level, the concepts that are contained in there go far beyond anything that was exchanged between Mr. Pittington and the officers via the handwritten notes.
Well, do I understand correctly that at the point where the informing the accused form was being utilized, that an interpreter was there, an interpreter from the Madison Police Department? Now, I understand she was not an American Sign Language interpreter, but apparently she was able to explain a number of things to your client. Is that not correct?
She was able to explain some things to my client. However, it's not just that she is not an American Sign Language interpreter. She is not a certified interpreter in any kind of language. She is somebody who has taken some courses at MATC, who did the best that she could, to give her credit, but introduces herself to hearing impaired individuals by saying that she signs very poorly, and the majority of what she's able to do is simply spell out words using the finger gestures and convey that to the individual in using English words and English word order, which isn't even close to American Sign Language.
Did she use that form of sign language when the form was being read?
Excuse me?
Did she use that form of sign language that she was acquainted with when the form was being read to your client?
It's unclear from the record. The officer testified that she initially attempted to do that, but as the conversation with Mr. Pittington went on in duration, she increasingly simply relied on what we refer to as lip reading. And she never specifically stated if she actually fingerspelled the entire informing the accused form. I think, given her testimony, it looks as though she probably did not.
One of the things I wanted to just follow through on, if I might, for a minute, was it's my understanding when the form was being utilized with your client that it was read by the officer, your client had a chance to read it, it was the American Sign Language interpreter was not there, but the interpreter was there. And your client was told to initial each paragraph if he understood it. And he did initial each paragraph. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But don't you think that's significant in terms of whether or not he understood what was going on here?
No, I don't. Mr. Piddington indicated in the videotape that's before the court that he understood certain things about the field sobriety test, for example. He indicated at times that he didn't understand, and some things he said that he did, and then he wasn't able to execute those things. So when Mr. Piddington said that he understood, we don't know what he thought he was understanding. We don't know what he thought that officer was saying to him. There is such a huge language barrier there that we don't know that he understood. When my waiter told me that he understood that I wanted fish, he brought me squid. Clearly, he didn't understand.
Well, let me just try it a different way. What do you think this court should state as its holding? In other words, should the court say that that it must provide, that the police, law enforcement, have to provide whatever it takes, so that if it's a foreign language, provide an interpreter in that foreign language, if it's sign language, provide that kind of interpreter, so that you provide the person with the with comparable facility or ability that someone who spoke English and heard English would have? Or does the court have to look at each case, which I think is some of the points of the questions of Justice Crooks and Justice Wilcox, court have to look at each case and decide whether that person understood what was happening?
I don't believe that the court has to look at each and every individual case. I think that that's what the court specifically said in Quelley they weren't willing to do, which is why they tossed out the idea that you could argue you were subjectively confused. But I do think that we have an objective problem here. And I think that the Constitution is more elastic than simply saying that you have to provide a qualified interpreter in each and every situation where there may be a language barrier. I think the amicus brief pointed out several ways of being able to address this problem without imposing the burden and expense of an interpreter on a law enforcement agency. A videotape, written informing the accused forms that have actually been reviewed with this issue in mind, whether you're able to adequately convey this information to the people. And I think that is required. If we say that the implied consent law imposes no obligation on the state or on law enforcement to ensure that those warnings have actually been conveyed in a manner that the drunk driver, accused drunk driver, has a hope of understanding, then I think we've eviscerated the entire purpose behind the implied consent law.
Counsel, you make arguments of due process, equal protection, throw in some ADA arguments, and statutory interpretation. What's your strongest argument?
I believe the strongest argument is simply looking at the purpose of the implied consent law.
The statutory argument.
Yes.
Okay. Then address that argument.
The implied consent law was not put into being so that police officers could obtain evidence of a drunk driving arrest. Police officers could do that without the implied consent law. It's why there's a specific provision in there that law is not to erode the officer's ability to constitutionally obtain the evidence in another fashion. They have always been able to do that. The implied consent law was implemented so that if somebody refused, that person would be penalized by a revocation of their license. It was a quid pro quo between the state and Wisconsin drivers. If you're going to be subjected to this punishment, if you're going to have that additional risk placed on you that would not be there if not for the implied consent law, then we're going to make sure that you know what it is your responsibility is under this law. And we're going to do that by reading to you the informing the accused form.
The Quell Court set forth a three-part test with regard to the test to be applied to assess the adequacy of the warning process under the implied consent law. In looking at that three-part test, is there one of the three that you think holds the answer to this case, or is the point of emphasis of your argument?
I think that all of the prongs are met. The first prong is certainly met. I don't believe that the officer met his obligation under the law, because I believe that the obligation under the law is to convey this information to accused individuals in a manner that they have a hope of understanding. And when the officer has been told from the very beginning of his contact with the individual that individual is deaf, needs an interpreter, then to simply read the form to them or to attempt to sign it very badly or allow the individual to lip read is not sufficient.
Getting back to Justice Wilcox's first question, then it sounds to me like you're making an argument that if the driver of the car happens to speak a language, let's say a dialect, and he's the only one in the city that speaks the dialect, he cannot be arrested for drunken driving?
Absolutely not.
Okay, let's see it.
There is a way of obtaining breath samples and blood samples. Usually blood samples if a person doesn't want to comply, from any accused drunk driver that does not involve the implied consent law in any fashion. In State versus Zilke, the officer placed Mr. Zilke under arrest. He consulted with, I believe, a district attorney, and they determined not to invoke the implied consent law. They simply took Mr. Zilke to the hospital, and they extracted a sample of his blood that was later analyzed for the alcohol concentration. That was fine. That's allowed. It's constitutional. It's permissible in Wisconsin. That option is always available to police officers. But if you're going to invoke the provisions of the implied consent law, if you're going to expose that individual to an additional risk, that being the revocation of his license for a refusal, then I think that you've got to provide that warning to the individual in a method they have a hope of understanding.
And let's just make it clear, there was no problem about arresting him here. He could be arrested, even if he didn't understand a word.
That's correct.
Because there was probable cause.
The trial court found that there was, yes. Okay.
And that's, you're not debating that. You're not fighting.
He did not raise that issue on appeal.
And they could charge him with drunk driving, and they could prove it with the blood test.
Correct.
So you're fighting the revocation.
No, there isn't a revocation in this case because Mr. Piddington did not refuse to submit to the test. So he couldn't be revoked for a refusal.
Mm-hmm.
What we are saying is that the only vehicle that the officer chose to use in this case was the implied consent law, and that was botched. That was not followed.
Ms. Jader, let me ask you this. You just mentioned the Zilke case. I would read the Zilke case as indicating that the remedy, if there's been a violation, does not have to be suppression of the test results. Now, that's what happened here. The trial judge granted a motion to suppress. Why should we grant a motion to suppress? Isn't that what you want? You want us to reverse the Court of Appeals and allow suppression of the blood test?
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe that the court's reading of Zilke is not correct. Zilke had nothing to do with what is the proper remedy for a violation of the implied consent law, because the implied consent law was never invoked. It was never attempted to be followed. It was simply a decision as to whether the implied consent law is the only means of obtaining the evidence, and it isn't. So it did not address the appropriate remedy for a violation of the law. Other cases have addressed the appropriate remedy for a violation of the implied consent law, and that has been suppression. If an individual has been denied his right to an alternate test under the implied consent law, for example, then the remedy is suppression of the state's test result.
Well, doesn't Zilke discuss McCrossin? And McCrossin was a situation, as I understand it, where there was suppression of the results. And doesn't Zilke explain it and seem to indicate there are remedies short of suppression?
I believe that there is a discussion in Zilke about that, but it is certainly not central to the issue that was decided by the Zilke court. I view it more as dicta, because the fundamental question is that in Zilke was whether the implied consent law is the only vehicle for obtaining a chemical analysis from an individual, and it is not.
Well, what case do you rely on, if any, that would require suppression of the results of the blood test here?
In State versus Renard, the officer invoked the provisions of the implied consent law. Mr. Renard submitted to the officer's primary test. He then requested an alternate test, or so the trial court found. The officer did not exercise due diligence, and thus Mr. Renard was not given his alternate test. The Renard court held that that violation of the implied consent law required a remedy, and that the appropriate remedy in that case was suppression of the state's primary test. That was the punishment for having violated the implied consent law. Now, I think that there can be ways around that. If the state, for example, proves that they would have obtained that evidence anyway, for example, if they can demonstrate that if Mr. Piddington had refused, they had a policy of obtaining forcible blood draws upon a refusal, that might be acceptable. They might be able to show that the obtaining of that evidence was inevitable and that there would be no taint on that evidence from the officer's violation of the implied consent law. But we don't have that record here in this case.
Counsel, it seems to me that your argument is stronger staying away from the individual, the myriad of citizens who may be arrested, whether they speak English or whether they speak Swahili, or even your hypothetical, whether understood the meat or the fish or the squid or whatever. It seems to me that's a difficult approach because of the slippery slope. And because it seems like a variation, as Justice Babbage's question, I think, inferred, a variation of the, subjective confusion, sort of thing. It seems to me that the stronger argument is the officer's conduct reasonable? And that's the stronger focus, and that's the first prong of the Quell test, I guess. But because to get into whether this particular, and I don't mean you're necessarily your client, but this particular drunk, mumbling person understood whether he speaks Swahili or Russian or doesn't speak at all, gets us into Never Never Land. And that the focus should be on the reasonably objective conduct of the officer. Can you respond to that? I may be missing a lot. It's been said before. So tell me why I'm wrong on that.
I think, obviously, you do have to look at the reasonably objective conduct of the officer. And I think that sort of backs you up even further to the constitutional implications that were raised by the Court of Appeals decision. And the constitutional implications are what we've raised in other parts of our argument, which is the equal protection argument and the due process argument. If the state has taken the step of implementing the statutory scheme, I think they certainly have to ensure that statutory scheme affects all individuals equally. And to say that it's equal because all individuals get read the form, I think, rings quite hollow. And I don't think that that's an explanation that people are willing to accept anymore in this day and age. 100 years ago, perhaps, but not any longer. Mr. Piddington had a right to have an equal access to understanding here that I would have or that the court would have. And if this is simply read to him or not provided to him in a way that he could understand it, he's been denied that equal access.
Don't you run into the same, and I guess the slippery slope is when you talk about what he understands, which is rather subjective in the sense that you're meeting people with reading levels, understanding levels from first grade through graduate school. And what you're saying is, well, this will go no further. Here we have a person who is deaf, and obviously he did not understand the form. And what I think Justice Bradley is suggesting, well, what did the officer do here that was reasonable or unreasonable? We should look at his or her conduct rather than to get started with going through the litany of what language, whether they understood, whether they had the capacity to understand, because that would be very difficult, and then we would be looking at case by case to see what the understanding of this particular person was at that particular time, what his education was, his or her education, whether they could hear, whether they understood, whether they had a reading level of first grade or as I say, 12th grade.
That's correct, and I don't think that the officer's actions here were reasonable. I have a red light. Does the court want me to continue to answer?
You may complete the answer to the question, please.
I don't think that the officer's actions here were reasonable. The officer was told that Mr. Pennington was profoundly deaf. He had no reason to believe otherwise. He continued to try to communicate with him in much the same way that you would with an individual who's not hearing impaired. It was an example sort of like simply talking more loudly and slowly to somebody that's deaf, as though that will somehow overcome this huge barrier. It won't and it can't. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Kathleen Potasek. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm representing the state of Wisconsin plaintiff in this action, counsel and Mr. Pennington. This court need not reach the federal question presented in the defense offered by Mr. Pennington. And the reason the federal question need not be reached here is because this is essentially a suppression case. The motion before the trial court that the trial court granted was a motion for suppression. Mr. Pennington raises a number of issues, number of claims, both in the trial court and on this appeal. It is the state's position suppression is not warranted under any of Mr. Pennington's claims. First of all, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the federal issue they raise, does not have a remedy of suppression of evidence. Secondly, the implied consent law, when it is followed, and even if it is not followed carefully, under this court's ruling in Ressler, does not warrant suppression of evidence. And third, and this goes to the heart of this case, I believe this is really an alternative test request case. Suppression can be a remedy if an officer improperly does not give an alternative additional test to a defendant under the McCrossin decision that this court has referred to in its questions. But as I believe it was Justice Crooks mentioned under the Zilke case, suppression is not always required, even if an alternative request for a test is not granted by the officer. But it is the state's position, first and foremost here, that Mr. Pennington never requested an additional alternative test. It is the state's position that the Court of Appeals properly applied the three-part Quell test, that the defendant has the burden of carrying on each of the three prongs. And this points to one of the errors, with all due respect, that the trial court made here. The trial court pointed out in its order that the state failed to carry its burden to show that Mr. Pennington was properly informed under the implied consent law. On the contrary, the Quell test indicates that it is the defendant's burden to show under each of the three prongs that the officer did not inform the defendant properly of the information. And the three prongs, of course, are whether the officer oversupplied or undersupplied information. Secondly, whether the oversupply or undersupply was misleading. And third, whether the oversupply or undersupply actually affected the defendant's ability to choose whether to take a test.
Counsel, if there is a violation of one of those three prongs, what's the remedy?
The remedy is perhaps to lose the automatic admissibility of the blood test or the test results, but it is not suppression. The Dressler case makes that clear. Suppression is simply not the remedy, and therefore Mr. Pittington cannot prevail on that portion of his claim. Justice Bradley, I believe that you pointed out that the question here is, one of the main questions is whether the Quell test was followed, and it is the state's position that Trooper McMahon gave an exemplary administration of the implied consent warning here. I would like to point out to the court a case that I raised in my brief, but I did not address for the specific reason I'm going to mention. In Mr. Pittington's reply brief, he indicates that he challenged the blood test that was offered, the breath test that was offered to him by Trooper McMahon, and Mr. Pittington was challenging the primary test. And for purposes of this discussion, the state will concede that Mr. Pittington, when he said, "I want a blood test," was essentially challenging which primary test Trooper McMahon would administer. And Trooper McMahon had a right to refuse to ratify Mr. Pittington's request for a blood test here. But nonetheless, Trooper McMahon consented or ratified Mr. Pittington's request to change the primary test. That is what Trooper McMahon did here. They were driving, and the video shows this very carefully, they were driving to District 1 for a breath test. Mr. Pittington apparently handed Trooper McMahon a note. Trooper McMahon states at, and I can even give the court the frame number of the video, at frame, I believe it was 1064, he gives him a note, and Trooper McMahon radios in with the message that there's been a change of plans. Please contact 1464 is the frame number of the video. He says, quote, "change of plans, my 95, apparently that's his code for the arrest he's made, my 95 is requesting a blood test. Will you contact the city officer responding?" He was attempting to have the city officer, who had some sign language ability, sent to Meritor Hospital rather than District 1. Now, the reason I bring all of this up is because to the extent Mr. Pittington argues that he was requesting an additional alternative test when he requested the blood test, he's wrong on two grounds. Number one, he testified at the suppression hearing, "I wanted a blood test too." The problem with that testimony at the suppression hearing is this. We have essentially a written transcript of the communication between the officer and Mr. Pittington the night of the arrest. And that transcript I am referring to is the notes that are in the record. And in his note to Trooper McMahon, Mr. Pittington did not say, "I want a blood test too." He did not say additionally. He did not say also. He said, "I want a blood test." At that point, Trooper McMahon turned the vehicle around and went to Meritor. So for that reason, I believe that Mr. Pittington fails in his burden of showing that he requested an alternative test. But in addition, the law that was in effect at the time, the statutes 1995-96, required this, and the informing the accused form that is in the record shows this clearly. Mr. Pittington initialed paragraph 3 of the informing the accused form. This is record number 27. In this case, paragraph 3 reads, "After submitting to chemical testing, you may request the alternative test this law enforcement agency is prepared to administer at its expense." In the case of the Bryant case, that's Village of Oregon v. Bryant, 188 with second, at page 691, this court found that in informing the accused form of essentially the same wording required this, quote, "It is clear from the informing document read to the accused that the alternate test may be asked for only after compliance with the test requested by the officer under the implied consent law." And I'm looking at the Village of Oregon versus Bryant case at page 684. The form that was administered at that time said this in relevant part, "In addition to the test or tests to which you have submitted at the request of a law enforcement officer, after submitting to these tests, you may request the alternative test the law enforcement agency is prepared to administer." So the after submitting language is similar in the Bryant case as in this case. And this court has ruled in Bryant that that means that you can only request that additional alternative test after the defendant has submitted to the primary test. The state's main position on Mr. Piddington's failure to prove that he asked for an alternative test is this. He asked for exactly one test, a blood test. He was given exactly one test, the blood test he requested. He got every test he requested. He never requested a test he did not receive. He never once indicated to Trooper McMahon he wanted a test alternative or additional to the blood test he asked for and he received. And there's absolutely no evidence that after Mr. Piddington submitted to the blood test at Meritor Hospital that he ever asked for a test in addition to his chosen blood test.
Counsel, could I ask you a question? You have taken issue with the trial court's use of the word term burden on the state. It seems to me the trial court made some findings of fact. What is the state's position on how this court should respond to the trial court's findings of fact?
Your Honor, it's the state's position, and I think that's a very important question. The trial court, first of all, one thing the trial court did not find is it did not find that Mr. Piddington actually requested an alternative test. And that's truly the only hope Mr. Piddington would have here in winning a suppression of the chemical test evidence. And this, it's the state's position, he falls very far short of meeting that burden. But secondly, Because of the way the case was argued to the trial court, Justice Prosser, the trial court essentially made a blanket legal ruling here. In specific, I will point to the record at record number 30, page 66. Mr. Piddington's counsel made this argument, quote, "I will just do one argument for all of the motions because they basically center around the same problem, and that's the communication problem that we have." Now, the motions related to a number of things, but the two relevant issues are whether there was an alternative test request and whether the implied consent warning was properly administered. Now, as a result of that approach, I would argue, the trial court's ruling was also intertwined as between all of those issues. The trial court did not distinguish between the facts found with respect to each motion. And instead, the trial court ruled this, that, quote, "The fact is the defendant needed an American Sign Language interpreter to really understand the information he was being given with respect to the alternative test," end of quote. And there is an additional ruling the trial court makes. But the trial court keeps them all together.
Do we accept that statement that you just read as fact, or is there room to find that that finding of fact was clearly erroneous? Well,
Your Honor, I think the best way to understand what I just quoted from the trial court is that that is a conclusion of law that the trial court reached based on some assessment of the facts. The trial court said that Mr. Piddington could not understand the information given. He could not really understand the information given. And that, Your Honor, I believe is with all respect, an erroneous application of the implied consent law of Wisconsin, where this court has previously held that subjective confusion is not a defense under the implied consent law in Wisconsin. So whether a person who, for whom there's probable cause to believe they have driven in an impaired state, really understands is truly beside the point, not only because this court has so ruled, but also because they are probably impaired. And to the extent Mr. Piddington tested 0.27 on his preliminary breath test, 0.206 on his blood test at Meritor Hospital, and any other impaired driver may have tested even higher. We cannot, I would argue, start applying a subjective confusion assessment to whether the officer has followed his or her obligation to administer the informing the accused under the law, as this court held just 2 years ago in the Reiter case.
Counsel, let me interrupt because I want to make sure that I understand your response to Justice Prosser. Then you can continue with the Reiter case. He read from the trial court the fact that the defendant needed an American Sign Language interpreter to really understand the information he was being given with respect to the alternative test, the field sobriety test, et cetera, et cetera. Do I understand your response to be essentially this, that that may be a factual determination, but it's irrelevant because it goes to subjective intent? So you initially started to say, well, that's not really a factual determination, but a conclusion of law. And I read that, and I thought, boy, it looks to me like a finding of a fact that the defendant needed an American Sign Language interpreter to understand. You know, there's the judge who's looking at everything. He can look at the nuances and see if the person seems to be needing an American Sign Language as opposed to the ALS or whatever it is. So I look at that as a finding of fact. I hear your response to say that's a finding of fact, not a conclusion of law. It's a finding of fact, but it's an irrelevant finding of fact because it goes to subjective confusion. Am I, now tell me if I'm right or wrong, because I want to get your response.
No, I think Your Honor is exactly right on that. I think to the extent that the trial court interpreted the implied consent law to require understanding on the part of the suspected drunk driver, the trial court was considering irrelevant facts. The implied consent law that was applied in this case said that the law enforcement officer shall orally inform the driver. And the officer must do that, whether the driver is a good reader or a poor reader, really drunk or not so drunk, whether the driver speaks Russian, whether the driver is hearing impaired, whether the driver is deaf. The law requires that the officer orally inform, at least the law at the time, orally inform that driver. And other assessments of the driver's understanding are irrelevant under that law. The law has since been changed to require that the officer read the form, but essentially the law requires the same thing.
Well, what does the state want this opinion to look like? What state's view that as long as the officer orally states this information according to the statute, there is no suppression. Now, there may be suppression on other grounds, but there's no suppression. And that the officer here was really very good, did everything possible for a hearing impaired person, but that all of these efforts were not required.
Your Honor,
is that what the state wants?
With one slight modification, Your Honor, this court ruled in the Bryant case that this court was not going to require a Miranda-like card be made of the implied consent warning, but urged the legislature to add to the scheme to state in the statute what information must be conveyed. And this court also ruled in the Ryder case that it's not for this court to add to the legislative scheme, but rather it is left to the legislature. So the state's position, consistent with this court's prior rulings, would be that the officer need only read the form to the driver. But as in this case, a good faith effort with a driver with impaired hearing may be to give the form to the driver so that he or she may read it as well, if that would in good faith fully administer the information. But, Your Honor, I caution the court that I am not suggesting that the driver, should that driver be a Russian speaker, be given a view of a Russian language interpretation of the statute, but merely be shown the form.
Counsel, what bothers me with your argument is this. First of all, this case comes under the 95-96 statute, which says orally informed. That provision has been interpreted by cases. When I say 95-96, I mean pre-95-96. Okay. That provision has been interpreted by our cases. I think page 16 of the defense brief has a laundry list of our cases interpreting that provision, orally informed. Some of the cases are the Quell case, but the implied consent warnings are designed to inform drivers of the rights and penalties applicable to them. And there's lots of cases. The Pishula case, the reasonable objective of that statute is to inform them of their rights and penalties regarding refusal. So we have the language of the statute that you have to orally inform. You have our cases interpreting that language that suggest to me that means you have to impart knowledge regarding the rights and penalties. We have many cases that essentially say that. Now you have a change in the statute that says the officer has to read. Now, it seems to me your argument is stronger in the revised statute. The officer has to read this. But in this case, under the law then existing and our interpretation of that law, it seems to me that the officer has to do more than just read a piece of paper. Let's say the officer had before him a person that he knew was profoundly deaf, hypothetically, and could not communicate, didn't go to high school, didn't have any formal education, didn't know how to lip read, didn't know how to sign. Is it the state's position under the statute then existing and our statute, that the officer meets his duty by knowing that hypothetical person and standing there and reading the informed consent under that our case law and the prior statute that was in effect at this case, does the officer meet the duty by reading that hypothetical person that statement?
Your Honor, absolutely, that's the state's position. There's
what is the purpose, then, of that language, to orally inform? The legislature, in its wisdom, decided to change it. We're going to say, now, officer, you got to read. But then it says orally inform. We have, and count them, I didn't, maybe 10 or 12 cases, I haven't looked at it the last few minutes, cited by the state, I've looked at a couple that interpret that means to impart knowledge. And you're just saying reading to some hypothetical person who absolutely the officer understands cannot in any way, shape, or form comprehend. And that's sufficient under that statute.
Yes, Your Honor, it is the state's position that it's sufficient because consistent with that prior language in the statute, this court also
rule that subjective confusion cannot be a defense. So the word inform in the statute did not mean any more than the commonplace meaning of read that is in the current statute, that this would be orally imparted to the defendant, and whether there's understanding is beside the point.
That's the difference, counsel, in the Quell case and what you focus on. In my hypothetical, and I might be all wrong on this, you know, I need help from you. In my hypothetical, I would say if the officer knew as true what I proposed in my hypothetical, I think that the officer's conduct would fall well below the duty to provide information to the defendant. Now, I'm focusing on the officer's duty to provide information and not even talking about whether or not this person understood or understood part. Do you understand? Am I making it?
I think what what I understand Your Honor to be saying is that there are two parts to this. There's the officer imparting information, and then there's the defendant receiving
the
information.
Part, the defendant, yeah.
Right. So we're focusing on the officer and how the officer imparts the information to the defendant.
I have a hard time thinking that the officer's conduct is reasonable in my hypothetical situation.
I believe that the statute has always required the officer to make a good faith effort to administer the information. And this may depend on whether the officer, as time has gone on and the statute has changed several times, this court urged the legislature to come up with a set of information that would be imparted to the defendant.
But your good faith, saying what is required is a good faith attempt, belies your argument that all that is required is reading.
Your Honor, I would suggest it's consistent with it in that the officer must orally impart that information. To the extent that the defendant receives it properly, the defendant, again, is probably drunk. To the extent the defendant receives the information is not the question. Under the Quell test, the officer must provide the information. When I read a good faith, Your Honor, I'm saying that impart the information in a good faith way. Don't whisper it so the defendant of whatever hearing ability can't hear it.
In response to my question where I stated what the officer should do, which is just read the stuff, you indicated that's right, but, and you added in a but, as I understood it, but I could be wrong, that you thought this court ought to say that the officer ought to do as much as he or she can do to make it understandable, but that we should not add to what the legislature has said. And that's how I understood your response. Now, the question is, are you backing off that, or have I misunderstood it, which is the same question I think that Justice Bradley is asking, namely, does the officer have to do more than just or inform or read?
Your Honor,
does the officer have to do more or less under the statute?
To the extent Your Honor suggests that I suggested that the officer do what he or she can to make sure the defendant understands. No, that's I don't believe I meant to suggest that. What I was suggesting was,
it's not required by the statute.
They're absolutely not. It's not now.
I think that passed out fully in a coma. You just read it to him over his body, then move the body out.
Because the statute provides the unconscious do not waive their consent.
Well, wait a second. Doesn't that make this portion of the implied? Doesn't that construction, if that's your construction of this statute, doesn't that make this portion of the statute completely irrational and meaningless
which is a due process violation. Oh, Your Honor, this court has repeatedly found that imparting the information orally to the defendant is not a violation of due process. The best argument, and it's not a good one, that Mr. Pennington can raise under due process was addressed in the McCrossin case. In that case, the court considered whether the denial of a request to an alternative test might raise a due process issue. But in McCrossin, this court ruled that, quote, defendant failed to make a plausible showing that an alternative test would have been favorable to him. And in other words, going to the question of whether he was denied exculpatory information.
Right, no, but that's a harm analysis. I'm talking about a statutory construction issue here. What does this statute mean? And it seems to me your position is that it means that the officer can read the form or orally inform, depending upon which statute you're looking at, and it's your position there to be construed the same, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so the officer can orally inform or read the form to the accused in any language and comply with the statute. So the officer could be confronted with an English-speaking driver and read the statute in Spanish, or the officer can be confronted with a Russian-speaking driver and read the form in English, or the officer could be confronted with a profoundly deaf driver who understands only American Sign Language and comply with the form by reading it in English. And it seems to me that's an irrational construction of the statute.
Your Honor, my position is that the officer must read the words that are contained in the statute in the English language.
And where does it say that?
It says the officer shall orally inform, and there's no indication that this comes in any language other than English. It's these words, and the officer must administer that information.
In
and
any I believe language, any other, regardless of whether the driver speaks that language.
Absolutely.
Or understands that
absolutely.
Language.
Absolutely.
Well, then it isn't a rational statute.
It is what the legislature has required. It is what the legislature has required, and many state legislatures in cases cited in the state's brief have found that that is sufficient.
It's a statute which serves no purpose then, at least in certain circumstances. And doesn't that, by definition, make it irrational?
Drivers are not obliged to drive on Wisconsin roads, but if they choose to do so, the legislature has ruled that they have impliedly consented to take a test under these circumstances.
I'm not talking about that part of the implied consent law. I'm talking about this part of the implied consent law, which has been construed to mean or to have the purpose of informing the accused driver of his or her rights and obligations under the implied consent law. And doesn't that implicitly mean that the driver has to be informed of that either orally under the old statute or read the form under the new statute in a language that he or she can understand?
The language
without
that he or she may not be able to understand.
Issue.
Right. That, exactly right.
And that is the state's burden to show in a motion hearing, right? The burden doesn't shift until we get into a Crowell kind of situation. The state has to prove compliance with the implied consent law.
The law has never been interpreted to require anything other than the English language reading, and the officer here made a good faith effort to comply with the law that existed at that time, which was to read this warning in English.
That goes to remedy rather than statutory construction. And the state is maintaining that as long as the officer reads the form in English, even if the accused driver has no English capacity, that that's sufficient.
That's correct.
Chief?
Justice Bradley.
If the officer is Spanish-speaking and the defendant is Spanish-speaking and the officer gives these words that are set forth in the statute in Spanish by the Spanish-speaking officer to these solely, only speaks Spanish, speaking defendant, it's your position that the officer then has not complied with the informed consent law because he hasn't read those words in English. Is that correct?
That issue is not in this case, but I would argue that the English language version should be administered.
What would be the remedy for this if this Spanish-speaking officer
gave the words to the Spanish-speaking defendant and therefore did not comply with the requirement that the words be read in English. What should be the remedy?
If the officer read them both in English and then in Spanish, yeah. You're saying only in Spanish.
Only in Spanish. Clearly the defendant only speaks Spanish, the officer is Spanish-speaking.
Sure. Under the Quell test, the question would be whether the officer oversupplied or undersupplied information. And it may be that the officer undersupplied information, but that did not mislead under the second prong of the Quell test, because the driver understood it anyway.
I'm going to ask the same question, but I'm going to say this. The officer does not read the information under four. What's the remedy?
The remedy is the state loses the automatic admissibility of the blood test, loses the ability to revoke the driver's license, and in Zilkey there's a third issue that I frankly can't recall right now, but the state loses some of its benefits.
But not suppression. That is my point.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Chavis.
Thank you. The court has brought up the change in the law that occurred in 1997, in part because the Court of Appeals rested its decision somewhat on that. And I would urge the court to look at the more important substantive change that actually occurred in 1997. The difference between Shall Orley and Form and Reed is really kind of semantics and I think much ado about nothing. The substance that was changed, the purpose behind that change was to take the informing the accused form that we had in Mr. Pittington's case, which has Section A and Section B and very complicated language and more complicated concepts, and simplify it. If the court looks at the new version that was enacted in 1997, clearly the intent of the legislature was to make the informing the accused form far more understandable than it had been before. And the purpose of that was not so that an officer can go through the mere charade of reading the form to an individual that can't possibly understand it. The purpose of that was to try to further ensure that accused drunk drivers understand what is being given to them, what is being read to them and conveyed to them. Understanding is clearly at issue here. That's one of the reasons, I think the primary reason, that the legislature made the change in the statute.
Could I ask you, counsel, did Mr. Pittington understand the implied consent law when he started driving on that night of February 14th, 1998?
We don't specifically have a record on that. In my opinion, I would argue no, that he did not. There's nothing that indicates he was ever provided with the implied consent law in a fashion that he was capable of understanding.
He applied for a license in Wisconsin.
That is correct. He did.
He probably had to go through some written material to get that license, didn't he?
I don't know. I don't know if they make specific adjustments for folks who are hearing impaired or not. I would expect he had to, but I'm not certain.
Well, let me ask this. Is there anything in the record that says that the officer indicated to Mr. Pittington that he was going to get a breath test?
I don't believe so.
All right. So if there's nothing in the record that says that the officer indicated he was going to get a breath test, he spontaneously wrote, "Please give me a blood test." Doesn't that indicate some understanding of what's going on here?
I think that we only have Mr. Pittington's testimony on that, Your Honor, which is that he understood he was being transported to the police station for a breath test. It's not clear how he obtained that understanding, and he attempted to convey to the officer that he wanted a blood test, too. And that's all that we have on that. I don't think that we can read anything into it other than that there was no questions asked by the prosecutor following up on it.
What is your position on this alternative test, that once he got the blood test that he seemed to be requesting, that he should also have had a breath test or a urine test, and it wasn't offered that?
That is correct, Your Honor, and I think that the state's correct to the extent...
Did he ask for a second test?
He attempted to, Your Honor, and I think what the court needs to look at here is the communication problems that were happening. It inhibited his ability to adequately convey that. Mr. Piddington, according to Trooper McMahon, was placed under arrest and put into handcuffs from the point in time that he was transported. He, I think according to the transcript, was left in handcuffs the entire time. He was handcuffed in front so that it wouldn't be as difficult for him to write or try to sign, but his ability to communicate was even further hindered. And he was attempting to convey to the officer that he wanted to test. Now, the state has mentioned that it's clear in the transcript that that's what Mr. Piddington wanted, but it wasn't clear on the night of his arrest. Well, there's a primary difference between Mr. Piddington's ability to communicate from the transcript to the night of his arrest. At the transcript, he was at the motion hearing, he had an interpreter. He was able to convey adequately everything he wanted. He did not have that luxury on the night of his arrest. He did not have somebody who understood his language. He was placed in handcuffs, and he had officers attempting to try to convey something to him, and he kept attempting to say, I don't understand, I need an interpreter. I think that Mr. Piddington did request an alternate test. I think it was imperfect, but I think in light of the circumstances that he was placed in, imperfect was the very best he could do.
Does it really make any difference legally if he actually requested the additional test once there's a violation of the implied consent law?
I don't believe there is, that it does make a difference. I believe that if the implied consent law has been violated and the state has not shown that they will proceed with testing under an alternative means, then I think that the remedy is suppression.
Is there any difference between the remedy of suppression and the remedy of losing the automatic admissibility of the test?
The automatic admissibility presumptions are actually found in 885.235, and I think that those would attach regardless of whether the implied consent law was followed.
Is it your position, counsel, that Mr. Piddington needed an interpreter to give instructions for the field sobriety test?
It's not only my position, Your Honor. I believe that that is a finding of the trial court. The trial court found that Mr. Piddington needed an American Sign Language interpreter to really understand not only the legal aspects, but the field sobriety test.
Okay, well now you've argued here that there's a way to get evidence by going outside of the implied consent law.
Correct.
But these field sobriety tests go to probable cause.
That is correct.
All right, now if you're saying that there needs to be an interpreter there, I mean, there's going to be no videotapes of American Sign Language in the squad car. There are no interpreters riding around. I mean, what is your position on this?
Like the use of the implied consent law, Your Honor, an officer is free to process a drunk driving arrest without field sobriety tests. An officer is free to do a drunk driving arrest without using the implied consent law. The officer... Field sobriety tests and probable cause is a common sense determination. In fact, if the court looks at the record, the trial court found that there was probable cause well before administering the field sobriety test, and that was based on the totality of the circumstances, which may or may not include field sobriety tests.
I'm going to just follow up on Justice Sykes' question. If there had been no orally informing here at all, what would the remedy be?
By that, do you mean, Justice, that the officer had not decided to invoke the provisions of the implied consent law at all?
Would that be the information in subsection 4?
There would be no violation. I think pursuant to State versus Bowling, California versus Schmerber, and the most recent decision, State versus Thorstad, by the Court of Appeals, there is an exigent circumstance exception that applies to obtaining chemical evidence of intoxication in drunk driving cases, and I think that applies in all the cases, and the officer is able to get a test without a warrant.
Okay, so there's not... Why are you asking for suppression? Isn't it the only remedy is that there's not automatic admission of this evidence?
No, Your Honor. Again, the automatic admission and reliability falls under 885.235. I don't think it's contingent on the implied consent law. In addition, if the what we have in this record is, as far as what the state has shown, is that the only means that they were going to use was the implied consent law. They didn't do that right. They did not lay a record, or they did not create a record that showed that they would have used any other means. In fact, there are law enforcement agencies that if a person refuses, they don't take a test. They just go with the refusal. They have a specific policy of not using an alternative means test, an alternative constitutional means. And we have no way of knowing whether that was the situation in this case or whether they would have used another constitutional means, because the state did not prove that.
Thank you, counsel.
If I could just clarify, yes. To follow up on the Chief Justice's question, your argument on suppression, as I understand it, is that under the line of cases which say that, or which says that suppression is the proper remedy when someone has been denied their right to an alternative test, this is falls within that line of cases because the defendant was effectively denied his right to an alternative test because he wasn't accurately, or in a language that he could understand, informed of that right by virtue of the language barrier and by virtue of the noncompliance with the implied consent law.
That's correct. I also do believe that the status of the law is, if the implied consent law has been violated, the remedy will be suppression unless the state is able to prove that they would have pursued an other constitutional means test. And we don't have that here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Before we adjourn for the December sitting, I want to welcome the students from Menominee Falls High School. Would they please stand so we can see you? Well, you've braved a cold, snowy weather, and thank you for coming. We hope you have learned from this exercise. You may be seated. For those in the audience here, the